and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. Recorded yesterday at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage, he gave the keynote address at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation Annual Outlook Luncheon. President of the AEDC, Bill Popp, provided the introduction.
Professor Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is one of the world's leading thinkers about work in the economy and has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and also on President Obama's Economic Transition Board. Professor Reich is the author of 14 books, and in his latest book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, a New York Times bestseller, Reich looks at where the economy is heading after the Great Recession and what to expect over the next decade. He has written more than 200 articles on the global economy, and his commentaries are heard weekly on public radio by nearly 5 million people. In 2008, Time magazine named him one of the 10 most successful cabinet secretaries in the past century. Ladies and gentlemen, another in a great line of speakers bringing different varied points of view to you, the audience of the business community of Alaska. Please join me in welcoming Professor Robert Reich to the 2012 Annual Outlook Luncheon.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and Governor Knowles, Mr. Mayor, others. As you can see, the economy has worn me down. I was here in January of 2006. AEDC invited Perrien and me up, and I was much taller then. Actually, somebody asked this morning, what's the big difference that you've seen in the Anchorage economy? You were here in January 2006, you're here now. The biggest difference, frankly, is the length of the day. The global economy and the national economy are not doing nearly as well as the Anchorage and the Alaskan economy. And so I thought what I would do with the limited time we have is to talk about that context, that is, what's happening in the lower 48 and also what's happening in the rest of the world, because that context is going to be critically important in terms of the forecasts for here, for what happens here in Anchorage and in Alaska. The bottom 48, as you may know, is suffering the worst and slowest and most anemic recovery we've actually seen from a deep recession since the Great Depression. And when you have an asset bubble that explodes, like the housing bubble, or like the debt bubble that exploded in 1929, it is very difficult to recover. There are two major ideas about how to recover. We've tried both of them, and they don't seem to work. One is, for shorthand, called Keynesianism. The idea is that government has got to be the spender of last resort when there's not enough demand in the economy coming from the private sector. Well, we spend a lot. And the problem is we're still in the gravitational pull of the Great Recession. Keynesianism doesn't seem to have worked this time. It's worked before. It doesn't seem to have worked this time. The other idea goes under the term supply-side economics. And the notion is that in order to create jobs, you want to provide tax cuts for companies and for wealthy individuals primarily so they have the incentive to generate more jobs and more investment. Well, we tried that. In fact, we started trying that in 2001, 2003. And the problem we saw is that we got actually less investment, lower wages, and slower growth after that tax cut than we had before. By the way, when I talk about wages, average wages are trending upward. But whenever you hear somebody who's an economist talking about averages, Watch your wallet. Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball player, and I have an average height of 6'1". Do you get my drift? You see, the people at the top bring up the average. What you want to actually do is look at the median. And one of the reasons that neither Keynesianism nor supply-side economics seems to have worked, starting in 2001, extending all the way through right now, is that we've got a problem with the median wage. That median wage is not the average. Median is the wage that's just halfway right there, half of the population above, half population below. If you adjust for inflation, the median wage since the 1970s has not increased very much at all. In fact, for men, the median wage is actually lower today than it was in 1978. How can that be? What's happened? What did we do to bring that on, but also what did we do to compensate for that? Well, one thing we did to compensate for that is the huge migration beginning in the late 70s of women into paid work in order to prop up family incomes that were stagnating or dropping because male wages were stagnating or dropping. But there's only so much that that can do. And when that coping mechanism started to wear out in the late 1990s, what did we do? We turned to our homes. And by then, housing prices were rising very, very dramatically, and people could take out home equity loans. They could actually refinance their homes very profitably and turn their homes into essentially piggy banks. That's what we did. Trillions of dollars we took out of our homes, starting in the late 1990s, reaching a kind of zenith in 2006. By the way, don't do as I do. People ask me for financial advice, and I tell them, and I warn them, don't do as I do, because my financial theory for personal investment has been to buy high and sell low. We bought our home in California in 2006, not just in 2006, but the very month that the housing market reached its highest point ever and will ever reach again. Well, essentially, the housing bubble blew up, and that left the typical wage earner in the United States, that is the median wage earner, without any more coping mechanisms. And so you really wonder, why is it that this economy has had such a tough time recovering? And one of the major reasons is there is not the purchasing power in the vast middle class of the United States to turn around and buy all of the goods and services that could be produced at full employment. I mean, if you're a business person, you are not going to expand and you're not going to create more jobs if you don't have customers, and you can't predict that you are going to have more customers with enough money to turn around and buy what you have. And that is, in a nutshell, the basic problem. I'm going to come back. I'm going to do some future forecasting in a moment. But when I do, I'll tell you really why we got into trouble in the late 1970s. You've got to understand that before you can really understand the long term in the future. Alaska has been insulated partly because of a natural resource base and also partly because of federal spending, military spending, and so forth. But what's happening in the bottom 48 is coming to a crescendo in what some people call a fiscal cliff, starting in January of 2013, just a few months from now, regardless of who's president. And that fiscal cliff is a result of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, not being able to get together to decide on whether to extend the Bush tax cut and also deal with spending cuts that are already scheduled to occur. So if nothing is done, and believe me, nothing will be done between now and January 2013. I will take anybody on a bet on this, because Washington is now at complete loggerheads. It is gridlock. Politics comes from the Greek root, poly, meaning many, and ticks, small blood-sucking insects. Present company excluded. No, I don't mean that, but certainly... No, I do mean present company excluded. I didn't mean that about politics. But certainly, if you go down to Washington, and I'm glad I'm no longer there, it is at complete loggerheads, and Democrats and Republicans will not make a deal after the election in that unique period of time in which sometimes Democrats and Republicans do get together. But that lame duck Congress is not going to get together. Democrats and Republicans I've talked to, both of them are going to hold out for a better deal. And come January, we are going to go off that fiscal cliff. And what does that mean? That means that the national economy is going to experience a tax increase and also major spending cuts. In military spending alone, we commence $500 billion of spending cuts. But we also have spending cuts across the board, and that is going to be felt all over the economy. By the way, the underlying, people ask me, what's the underlying budget problem? Why are we facing these huge deficits in the out years that have to be addressed? Somehow they have to be addressed. And the answer really is the combination of two things. Number one, rising healthcare costs. Now, 18% of the entire national economy will be 20% of the entire national economy in 5 years and 25% in 10 years if we don't get control over rising healthcare costs, combined with baby boomers whose bodies are all going to be corroding together en masse over the next 20 years. You've got 76 million baby boomers who started to be born in 1946. I was born in 1946. George W. Bush was born in 1946. Bill Clinton was born in 1946. Anybody who's anybody was born in 1946. Why were we? Cher was born in 1946. When I get a little depressed about being old, I remember that Cher was born in 1946. Now, why were we all born in 1946? Demographics is not all that complicated. We were born in 1946 because, well, I can speak personally, my father was in the Second World War. And he came home. And there was my mother, and that was it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a demographic specialist. And we were all born, and then you see this huge, huge increase beginning in 1946. And then a kind of extending until about 1964, 76 million, and all of us are now beginning to retire. We're getting older, and the bodies are going ensemble together as healthcare costs are going up. How are we possibly going to afford the two of them unless we get control? We're not going to get control over the 76 million. Hopefully, we're going to go on living. So hopefully, we're going to get control over healthcare costs. And yet, we still have the most inefficient healthcare system you can imagine. I was interested in Bill's charts. One of the fastest growing job categories in Anchorage is healthcare and health services. Well, that's great in one way, but somebody's got to pay. So in another way, it's not so great. Healthcare services around the country are ballooning and will continue to balloon, but you've got a health insurance and healthcare system that is designed around the proposition of avoiding sick people. Do you understand? In other words, health insurers, and God love them. I mean, they are doing what they have to do. They need to make money, and they are spending a lot of time marketing and advertising to groups of people who are relatively healthy and trying to avoid groups of people that are relatively unhealthy. Now, that may change with regard to pre-existing conditions and the new healthcare law, but nevertheless, that is our system, and we spend a lot on it, but we don't seem to get very much out of it. At the same time, we don't have very much prevention going on. That is, other nations may not have as great a system as we have. They don't spend nearly as much, but they spend more on prevention, preventing healthcare problems before they arise. We don't turn people away from emergency rooms when they get very, very sick, but ideally, we should spend more on prevention. My father is 98 years old. When he was 85, he began walking 5 miles a day. He's now 98, and we don't know where he is. No, that's not true. We know where he is, and he's taken prevention very seriously. I've undertaken a kind of free-floating focus group among baby boomers. I don't want to spend too much time on boomers, but this is important, even in Alaska and in Anchorage, given your health care jobs and also given the dependence necessarily of this state on exports, not only to the rest of the globe, but also to the bottom 48. So I've done a kind of free-floating focus group asking people who are just about to retire or people who are within 15 years of retirement, that is baby boomers, what do they expect in retirement? And what I get back from them is a kind of vision they all have. And I call it a med-med vision, kind of a cross between a Club Med and a medical facility. You know, snorkeling in the morning, extra oxygen in the afternoon. And they think that they are, baby boomers, and I'm included, we think we are going to be able to afford this, but we haven't saved. In fact, one of the most troubling aspects of the current difficulty we're having getting out of the gravitational pull of the Great Recession is that the typical family, again, I'm not talking about average, typical median family's net worth is 40% below what it was in 2006. Now, a lot of that is housing prices coming down. That's where the big net worth was for most people. But how, if you're a baby boomer, how are you going to save? How are you going to afford a med-med retirement if your net worth is down 40%? And also if you're worried about your job. So that whole idea, Social Security is not in terrible shape. Social Security is in reasonable shape. But you've got a Medicare and Medicaid system that are both going broke. And they're going broke partly and largely because medical costs are going up so fast. And also the projections show that you've got all these baby boomers. So it's not Medicare and Medicaid that are the problems. The problems are the underlying medical system that continues to bankrupt and will continue to bankrupt all of us if we don't get some control over it. When we get time for your questions, we can talk about how to control those costs in a moment. But I also want to talk about another major problem we face collectively, and that is the global economy. Now, globalization is one of those words that have gone from obscurity to meaninglessness without any intervening period of coherence. But when I'm talking about globalization, I am talking about a system of highly and ever more integrated trade and direct investment and immigration. And that global system is something that a place like Alaska, that is resource rich, that is dependent economically and in many other ways on commodities sold into a global economy, has got to be aware of the cracks that are developing in that global economy. One major crack in that global economy is obviously Europe. Continental Europe and Britain, Great Britain. In fact, I was just a few minutes ago, before I came here, on the phone with the BBC. And they're very worried about the fact that they seem to be following their way into the morass that continental Europe is moving in. Continental Europe and Great Britain are basket cases. Moody's issued a report about a day ago saying and warning that even Germany is going to have a credit or is likely to have a credit downgrade, even Germany. Germany is one of the strongest economies in the world, but Germany is so dependent and so laden down with the debts and the responsibilities that come from the Eurozone, and there are so many sick states in the Eurozone. It's not just Greece. By the way, Greece has already defaulted. Did you know that? Are you aware? I mean, nobody's talking about that. But Greece is effectively defaulted. All Greece's creditors don't want to announce the fact that Greece is no longer paying them. for fear that there would be a bank run on Greece that's even worse now. But what Europe has done is it basically has taken to Greece, it's extended the terms of all of the loans to Greece. It continues to extend those terms, kicking the can down the road. Meanwhile, the contagion has spread to Italy. It has now spread to Spain. Spain is contracting. Obviously, Greece is contracting as an economy. Italy is contracting as an economy. The Netherlands, very, very close, in danger of contracting. France may be in recession. Certainly this coming year, it looks like France is going into recession. Britain is in recession. And Germany is not yet in recession, but it is trending toward a recession. Now, all of those, that, I mean, Europe is a big place. Europe is important in the scheme of the global economy. Europe is a major importer of commodities. And so if Europe goes into recession, as it seems to be trending into recession, that is going to affect all of us. It affects the United States, not because the lower 48 is a major exporter to Europe. You are a major exporter directly and indirectly to Europe, but also because our financial institutions are exposed to European banks. Nobody knows exactly the degree of that exposure, but that exposure is significant. One reason we don't know the degree of that exposure is our financial system, even to this day, after 4 years of looking at what happened in 2008 on Wall Street, we still don't know very much about the books of many of these major banks. JP Morgan, what, $5.8 billion loss on risky loans? Said it was a $2 billion loss. We don't know to this day what JP Morgan Chase has by way of exposure to European banks. We don't know what Morgan Stanley has by way of exposure to European banks. And as those European banks are under greater and greater stress, those stresses affect Wall Street and Wall Street banks. If you think that the bailout of Wall Street in 2008 won't happen again, watch your wallets once again. Have I cheered you up yet? Because I want to also go on to China. China is a major commodity importer. China's growth is slowing. Now, the good news is China's commodity imports are not slowing. In fact, on an annualized basis, last quarter, China was importing commodities, particularly oil, at a 12% annualized rate of increase. Now, that's much faster than China is growing, but China's growth is slowing, and the danger signal on the horizon is that that commodity import engine cannot continue. Why is China's growth slowing? Well, it's because everything is related to everything else in the global economy. China's growth is slowing in part because China is dependent on exports. Where is it dependent on exports to? The United States and Europe are major customers, and the European economy is contracting, and the United States is still in the gravitational pull of this great recession. So naturally, China is going to slow. There's been a lot of talk about Chinese consumers and China changing from an investment culture and economy into a consumer culture and economy. Don't believe it. It is true that Chinese consumers are now richer and taking a greater share of the Chinese economy than before, but they are still only 35% of the total Chinese economy. Most of the investment in China is not going into propping up consumers, it's not going to wages, it is going to capital investment. And that capital investment is simply making the Chinese economy larger and larger and more dependent on exports because Chinese consumers can't absorb all of that capital investment. Again, connect the dots. And you see that Anchorage and Alaska have escaped much of the problems of 2008, and I hope you all continue to escape these problems. But beware of these danger signs on the horizon with regard to the lower 48 and also with regard to the global economy. Now, let me put my futurist hat on. I've got to preface this by warning you. I was thinking about this when Governor Knowles was talking about 25 years ago and what happened in 1986, what happened in 1987. In October of 1987, almost 25 years ago, I got a reputation for being an economic soothsayer. Now, it all happened because, and I've got to tell you this so that you can measure the weight and veracity and power of my soothsaying capacities right now, and I've got to share this with you. It was a national television program, and I was on opposite another economist, and the question we were being asked to address was, what's going to happen to the United States economy over the next few months? This was the first week of October of 1987. I don't know where you were. Maybe some of you were not alive then. But you might remember what happened the third week of October of 1987. Anyway, the question was, where are things going? This other economist said, I am so bullish. Everything's going to go even better over the next month or two. If you're not in the stock market, get in. If you're in, get in more, deeply. Don't even wait till the end of this program to call your broker. Get in. He was foaming at the mouth. I came to my turn and I said, no, he's absolutely wrong. I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen, but it seems to me that about 2 weeks from now, the economy is going to lose about 20% of its value. And so I would get out. In fact, I don't even think we should wait till the end of this program to get out. Call your broker, get out right now. In retrospect, I don't think anybody saw the end of the program, regardless of who they believed. But 2 weeks later, the market did lose 20% of its value. And I was overwhelmed with phone calls and messages, people trying to sign up for my investment letter. But I told them with some sadness and regret, I did not have an investment letter. What I didn't tell them, and I'm going to share this with you so you can evaluate my forecasts, but please keep it in this room. What I didn't tell them is that forecast I'd made that over the next 2 weeks, the economy would lose 20% of its value, I had been making exactly the same forecast for 4.5 years. You see, I missed the bull market entirely. So that just goes to show, if you stick to your guns with regard to economic forecasting, you will have your own newsletter. By the way, economic forecasters, and this is not to cast any aspersions on the fine work that Bill and his staff has done, but economic forecasters exist to make astrologers look good. But here's what I foresee. I think we will inevitably get out of the trough of the Great Recession and the very slow and anemic recovery we've seen. I think Europe will turn it around. I think we will get to the January fiscal cliff in the United States, and I think Democrats and Republicans, waiting till exactly the last minute, probably on midnight, or maybe January 2nd or 3rd, they will come up with a deal that extends the Bush tax cuts, but also postpones some of the spending cuts. And I think that we will continue to kick the can down the road. I think China will continue to grow. And I also believe, for all of those reasons, that Alaska and Anchorage and the economy here will continue to do well. I think Bill's forecasts look very reasonable and very right to me. But I do want to summarize what I've said and also put it in the form of a suggestion. I'm not so presumptuous as to think I know anything about the Anchorage or the Alaskan economy in detail, but I have a suggestion. And the suggestion really comes directly out of what Governor Knowles was talking about in the 1980s. Because no natural resource-based economy is free from profound dangers. And those dangers have to do with uncertainty. Uncertainty in terms of demand in the global market, but also uncertainty in terms of supplies. Anybody who knows anything about the natural resource and extraction industries knows how quickly technologies are changing the nature of the game. Whether we're talking about shale gas or fracking, or we're talking about liquid natural gas, or we're talking about any form of technology, the game is changing very rapidly. And the geology and geography of that game are also changing very rapidly. It is very important, therefore, that any economy that is natural resource-based not only make the investments in sustainability that it needs to make, and I'm sure Alaska is doing that, but also keeps in mind two fundamental realities. Number one, diversification. Like any financial portfolio, diversification is safety. The more diverse the economy, the safer the economy. And second, investment. Investment in infrastructure, but also investment in education. The one resource in the global economy that is the most valuable and also the most sure resource that a nation or a state or a region has is the skills and insights of its people. The gap between technology and natural resource is growing smaller and smaller. What will make the future of Alaska or Anchorage or any place rich in natural resources is a workforce skilled enough, knowledgeable enough to continue to innovate with regard to exploration, discovery, extraction that is clean and efficient and relatively cheap, but also the ability to innovate in many other areas. We are living now, and this is the best news of all, in a period of innovation like we have not seen before in the world. And those innovations, mostly in digital technologies and also in technologies having to do with the genome, those technologies and those innovations are going to transform our lives so profoundly that we can't even predict exactly what the jobs of the future are. But investing in those technologies, public sector and private sector investment, investing in education, investing in infrastructure is the key to the future and the key to a diversified economy that will be strong regardless of what happens to the supply or the demand for natural resources. So it's good news. It's not sobering news. But that good news has within it a fundamental challenge. Thank you all very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Robert Reich, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor. Recorded yesterday at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation Annual Outlook Luncheon, Mr. Reich gave a keynote address and then responded to questions from the audience.
If you have a question, please hold them up in the air. They'll be brought up to me, and I will get those questions to Professor Reich.
And Mr. Mayor, you can yell if you'd like.
Okay, the first question that I have is, if the 2009 stimulus was two times what was actually made available, what impact would that have had on the economy if we'd been more aggressive in investing in the stimulus?
The stimulus package, which was less than $800 billion over 2 years, was in the minds of many people, including my own mind, not large enough. But the problem that I try to emphasize with you is that even if the stimulus had been twice as large, it would not have done the trick because it is still temporary. Unless you have a workforce that has enough money in their pockets to take that stimulus and continue to spend once that stimulus is over with, then you're not going to have a sustainable economic recovery. And that's the underlying problem. I testified in January of 2008 as to how big the stimulus ought to be. I was with two other economists, one Marty Feldstein, who had been the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Ronald Reagan, And the second person was Mark Landy. Mark had been the chief economic advisor to John McCain in the 2008 campaign. And the three of us were called up to say, and to be asked by Congress, by members of Congress, what size the stimulus ought to be. Marty Feldstein was first. And they asked him, and he said $800 billion. And I turned to Mark Landy, who was standing next to me, and said, or sitting next to me, and I said, Mark, where, and I whispered this because I didn't obviously want anybody to hear. I said, Mark, where did Marty get that $800 billion figure? Because nobody knew at that time how much the economy was falling off the cliff, how large the gap was between demand and potential unemployment. And Mark Landy turned to me and said, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea where Marty got that $800 billion. And then they, the panel turned to Mark Landy and said, how big should the stimulus be? And he said, $800 billion. And then they came to me and I said, $800 billion. But it was all guesswork. The most important point, again, is that Keynesianism, even John Maynard Keynes talked about pump priming. He talked about the idea of government spending was priming the pump until consumers and businesses could take over. But pump priming doesn't work if there's not enough water in the well to begin with, if you follow that analogy. And that's why Keynesianism doesn't work if people don't have enough money in their pockets.
Okay, we have been literally inundated with questions, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that we have a good 20 minutes to try and get through as many of them as we can. I'm trying
we're going to go till 3 o'clock. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah. Nobody has anything to do, right? Yeah. No. Oh. All right. Let's jump into a topic that you touched on in your presentation. Regarding increasing costs in the medical field, what changes in the Affordable Care Act will contribute to real cost reductions for consumers, if any? And if there are none, what are your recommendations for real medical cost reform?
Well, I think there are two major places in the Affordable Care Act where there is potential for cost saving. I don't think there's enough cost saving in the Affordable Care Act to begin with, but the two areas where there are potential for cost saving are, number one, in the insurance exchanges, where ideally people are able to compare price and quality with regard to what they are getting and therefore make more informed decisions. Those exchanges are being organized by every state in slightly different ways. The states have a lot of leeway. I frankly don't know what you're doing here in Alaska, but I know that some states are taking them very, very seriously and are using them to try to control costs. The other place in the Affordable Care Act where costs could be controlled is that there are a lot of experiments built into the act with regard to trying to see what kind of accountable care organizations, that is, organizations that take money in to prevent health problems from developing, instead of fee-for-service, basically fee-for-high-quality, healthy outcomes, what kind of organizations are most effective? And those experiments that are built into the Act should and could yield a lot of information. Finally, what would I recommend? It seems to me that at the very least, we want to give Medicare and Medicaid, which are huge programs and have huge potential bargaining leverage over the healthcare system, we want to give them the opportunity to assert that bargaining leverage to keep healthcare costs down and to move from a fee-for-service to a free fee-for-healthy outcome system. Right now, under the Act and under previous legislation, they do not have the right to exercise that bargaining leverage. That was a deal made with the drug companies and with the insurance companies, and I think it was a lousy deal.
What about the Glass-Steagall Act? Wouldn't that help protect America's economy and make government spending more successful in stimulating the economy?
Well, the Glass-Steagall Act, for those of you who are historians, may remember that was a Depression-era piece of legislation designed to separate investment banking from commercial banking, so that we would not face the same thing we faced heading into the Depression, where basically banks were using commercial deposits to gamble with. But in 1999, I regretfully say, under the Clinton administration, the administration joined the Senate and joined the House in essentially repealing Glass-Steagall. Now, there's controversy around as to whether Glass-Steagall would have avoided or would have prevented the meltdown of 2008. I don't think it would have, but is it a good idea to resurrect Glass-Steagall, to separate commercial from investment banking again? I think it is. I think it's very important that those who are betting in the casino of Wall Street, and that betting is fine, if they want to bet, fine, but they should not use commercial deposits, and particularly federally insured commercial deposits, to do that betting. We need to reestablish, in my view, we need to reestablish that wall. Otherwise, we're going to go back to too big to fail. I'll tell you something else. You didn't ask, Bill, but as long as I'm on the subject, I think that we ought to break up the big banks so that no bank is too big to fail. I think that's a basic, fundamental law of American finance. And by the way, I was interested that this morning, this very morning, Sandy Weill, W-E-I-L-L, came out on CNBC and said, I think the big banks ought to be broken up. Now, I thought that was interesting because Sandy Weill, if there's any single person who is responsible for the biggest Wall Street banks becoming gigantic Wall Street banks, it's Sandy Weill. Sandy was the one who created, out of Travelers and Citicorp, the gigantic Citigroup that we now have on Wall Street. Sandy also was the single most important proponent in the 1990s of abolishing, of getting rid of repealing Glass-Steagall. And for him to say this morning that the big banks need to be broken up so that we do not have a repeat of too big to fail and a taxpayer bailout was an historic occasion. It's just that he was a little bit late.
Straightforward question. How do you propose we save Social Security?
Well, Social Security is really not a huge problem. Social Security is basically in pretty good shape for the next 25 years. Social Security can be saved by doing any number of things. Number one, we could increase the retirement age a little bit. You know, in 1935, when Social Security was created, the average lifespan, I mean, my predecessor at the Labor Department, Francis Perkins, came up with Social Security, and Franklin D. Roosevelt signed it, but the retirement age was 65, but the typical lifespan in 1935 was 61. So it wasn't such a great deal. Right now, the typical lifespan, if you're a man, is about 80 years, a woman about 81, 82 years, and so you have a much, much longer period of retirement. I think we could lift the retirement age a little bit, as Alan Greenspan and the Greenspan Commission did. I think we could means test Social Security a little bit more than we do. We could also lift the portion of income subjected to Social Security payroll taxes. Right now, it's $110,100. Every dollar above that that you earn, you don't have to pay Social Security taxes on. So Bill Gates fulfills his yearly Social Security obligations at about 2 minutes past midnight, January 1st of every year. So those are three things that could be done. None of them has to be done in a big way, but you do a combination of those three things and you take care of Social Security problems for the next 75 years.
So pulling on your history as a professor of economics, why do we use consumer spending confidence as an economic indicator instead of personal savings or net worth?
Consumer confidence. I don't believe that consumer confidence should be a terribly strong indicator. It has not proven to be a terribly strong indicator because confidence goes up and down weekly. I mean, you can't, I know that you've tried, Bill, to develop a consumer confidence index here in Anchorage. I don't know how you measure it. But basically, the National Consumer Confidence Surveys are just opinion surveys. And if people are feeling kind of blue, if it's bad weather, in other words, this summer in most of the lower 48 has been unusually warm. It's been a bad summer. And people are grouchy. And so consumer confidence is down not only because people don't expect the economy to do better, but because they're in a bad mood. That's not a very good indicator of the future. So I would say a better indicator of the future has to do with inventories, also basically savings and saving rates, and also a very important indicator is the opinions of employers about their customers. This is a survey that I've been for years trying to get the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the BEA in the Commerce Department to do, but what employers assume about their future sales is a much more important indicator of job growth than any other indicator, and we don't really have good data on that at all.
Question from the President and CEO. How did you enjoy your time down on the peninsula?
We had a wonderful, wonderful time. We went to, Perry and I, when we were here in 2006, we went down to
Seward,
and we got caught in a blizzard, but it was January, and so the day was fairly small, short. We didn't see much of Seward because of the blizzard and the short day. So this time we went down to Homer, and even though it rained, it was a very long day. In fact, several days, we had a wonderful time. We went to a little glacial lake. We hiked in about 3 miles. We almost surprised, in fact, we did surprise a brown bear and her cub. She surprised us. And we decided we didn't want to have anything to do with them, and they didn't want to have anything to do with us. And so it worked out great, and we now have a story to tell.
Do you believe overregulation is part of the problem with our national economy?
It depends on, I mean, there is absolutely no justification at all for regulations whose costs to business or to consumers or to anybody else are greater than the benefits. Any regulation that can't meet the cost-benefit test should be thrown out immediately. On the other hand, over the last several years, we've seen enough with regard to financial markets and other areas of the economy where we certainly do need more and better regulation. More regulation is not simply enough. We need better regulation. The Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, for example, I think is a step in the right direction, but it's been watered down so much. And there's still, as we talked about before, no wall, no Glass-Steagall in that financial reform bill. So it's a lot of paperwork. It may not be very effective. So the cost-benefit analysis is the key. It's not an ideological predisposition as to whether you like regulation or don't like regulation. It's whether the regulation is justified because the benefits exceed the costs or not justified because the costs exceed the benefits.
A couple of questions regarding Simpson-Bowles. Just to encapsulate them, do you support all or part of the Simpson-Bowles report? Why or why not?
I think the Simpson-Bowles, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles did an extremely good job in coming up with a deficit reduction plan. I think that the one quibble I have with it has to do with the trigger. You see, everybody is in favor or should be in favor of deficit reduction. There's no question about that. We've got a very large deficit. The deficit's already, the total debt is about 70% of our GDP. That's way too high. But let me just make sure we're all together on this. Getting the debt down really means getting down the relative proportions of the debt to the total GDP. Can I say that again? Because your eyes are all glazed over. What we want to do is reduce the ratio of the debt to the total economy. That's the goal. So if you do what Europe is doing, and actually start reducing the debt, cut spending and raise taxes too early before the economy is recovered, what you end up doing is shrinking the size of the economy and actually making the ratio of the debt to the economy worse than it was originally. That's the austerity trap that Europe has got itself into. So my only quibble with Simpson-Bowles is that they don't have a trigger for when you start serious deficit reduction. I would say the trigger ought to be 5% unemployment nationally and 3% economic growth. on an annualized basis. When you hit that trigger, boom, that's when you start serious deficit reduction, tax increases, and spending cuts. But until you get there, you're in danger of an austerity trap, just like Europe is facing, if you start doing it too early.
You've talked to us about the United States, about Europe, and about China. Can you comment on what you're seeing with South America as an emerging player?
Well, Latin America is really a lot of different economies. Chile is a very strong economy. It's going to remain a very strong economy. It's a strong economy because not only its natural resource base, but it has a lot of diversity. It has a lot of innovation. Brazil and Argentina are natural resource-based economies, and they are commodity economies. Brazil and Argentina depend on China. As China growth slows, Brazil, which had been extraordinarily quick, very, very fast grower, is also slowing. Argentina is also slowing. Another difference between different places in Latin America has to do with the degree of corruption. Argentina is corrupt. Can I say that any more clearly? Its biggest economic problem is corruption. If it doesn't solve the issue of corruption, it's not going to grow. Brazil has an economy that is very similar to Argentina's, but it is not nearly as corrupt. That means Brazil is going to continue to grow faster than Argentina. Mexico has its own problems. I mean, what has happened between Colombia and the United States border with Mexico is that essentially we have a drug trafficking problem that is consuming resources and actually slowing every economy between Colombia and the U.S. border. And it's getting to be a larger and larger problem.
What are your thoughts about the increasing dependency on government welfare versus self-reliance thinking?
Well, in this country, we have always had something of a balance between self-reliance and the idea that if somebody or a family gets into trouble through no fault of their own, there ought to be not so much a safety net. I think the safety net metaphor is probably inappropriate. There ought to be a trampoline so that somebody who loses a job or somebody who because of a major medical problem loses their savings, they can find their way back into the economy. They can, again, like a metaphor of a trampoline, they can bounce back, and they and their family can bounce back. If we don't have effective trampolines around, we're going to have an even higher rate of poverty. You all know, at least in the bottom 48, that the poverty rate is now going up again. For years, that poverty rate was fairly low and fairly stable. It's now trending up quite dramatically, largely because of job losses and also because of the loss I indicated before of 40% of net worth of the average family and the typical family. What should our policy be? We don't want to coddle people. We don't want people to feel like they have no responsibility, but we also, in any civil society, want to make sure that people have a fair chance, and particularly their children.
There's been several questions regarding unions, so I've picked this one as kind of the representative of those questions. How much does collective bargaining contribute to the financial situation that we're in now, good or bad?
Look, the unionized sector of the private sector of this country is now down to 7% of the workforce. So if anybody thinks that collective bargaining of the 7% of the workforce is responsible for bringing down the economy, they're just not looking at history. When, in the 1950s, 35% of American workers were unionized, we actually had faster economic growth, and we had higher real wages relative to what we have now, and we also had a more stable economy. So unions, I don't think, are a problem. Now, public sector unions are obviously very controversial, I think largely not so much on the wage side, because if you compare per education, that is how much education somebody has in the public sector and the private sector, public sector and private sector workers, unionized or non-unionized, are about on par. The difference has to do with the benefit side. And some states, particularly with regard to public sector workers, have got into trouble. The state budgets are in deep trouble, like in California. because of deals that have been made with public sector workers. I'm not saying that those deals are necessarily bad, but undoubtedly they have been underfunded.
Where does the U.S. Treasury stand with TARP repayments from the big banks? And I think the intent of the question and a couple of other similar questions is, did we lose money on TARP? Are we making money on TARP? Are we getting our money back?
TARP, you know, rarely has an acronym been so appropriate in terms of describing something that hides what really is going on. The TARP program, we've got a lot of the money back, but we failed to do several things, and this is a problem both that goes back to the George W. Bush administration and also the early days of the Obama administration. Number one, we didn't take equity stakes. We, that is taxpayers, who bailed out the banks, we basically did not take any equity stakes so that as the banks bounce back, we would get some of the benefits of the bounce back. I mean, Warren Buffett was smart enough to take an equity stake in some of the banks that he, in effect, helped bail out, but we did not. Secondly, we did not put any conditions on the bailout. So we didn't say to the banks, for example, you've got to mitigate and modify a lot of the loans so we don't have one out of five Americans with a mortgage underwater forever. We didn't say to the banks, you have got to accept some provisions such as the resurrection of Glass-Steagall. We didn't say to the banks, you have got to accept certain ideas and certain reorganizations so no bank is too big to fail. We didn't say to the banks, you cannot, at least with regard to bank regulation, you cannot use public funds to lobby Congress against future regulations designed to prevent another bank bailout. We didn't do any of this. And so, on that basis, I think TARP did not work out all that well. There is still money owed to taxpayers. And we're talking about something in the range of about $120 billion when I last looked. Not chump change. Well, it is chump change, actually.
Our final question. What role should a university play in economic development, diversification, or in the growth of a community?
Universities have a very pivotal role in economic development and in diversification of economies. Universities are, number one, the place where a lot of research is done, basic research and applied research. Number two, universities can be a center of spin-off technologies and small businesses, particularly if they are surrounded by incubators that are on the lookout for research that could be commercialized. And number three, universities are terribly important in terms of training and developing a workforce that knows how to identify and solve the problems of the future, that are really the innovators of the future. So I think that universities are very, very essential. And what you see around the country when you look at universities and innovation is basically universities become centers of innovation and can be terribly important centers of innovation. I'm going to be heading off this afternoon to the University of Anchorage. I'm looking forward to talking to students there, and hopefully you are all taking advantage of that important resource.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Robert Reich.
Thank you again.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Robert Reich, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor. He responded to audience questions following his keynote address at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation Annual Outlook Luncheon, which was recorded at the Dynana Center in Anchorage on July 25, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.